James Kirchick joins me on the line from Melbourne. James, good morning. Welcome to Tasmania Talks. How are you?
Thanks. Great. Thanks for having me.
It's a complete pleasure. I intend to pick your brains for the next few minutes, if you don't mind. The title of your book is somewhat catastrophic, The End of Europe, The Coming Dark Age. Can you clarify both of those terms for me and how you write about them in the book?
Well, it's really a wake-up call, and I think it's what I'm trying to warn about is the end of Europe as we've known it, really, which is the past 75 years of relative peace and prosperity. And I think if you go back maybe 30 years ago to 1989, we had three assumptions about Europe. The first was that liberal democracy would be the final end stage of human development. Mm-hmm. This was the collapse of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the spread of democracy into Central and Eastern Europe, and the sort of in the reunification of Europe. The second was that there had been a consensus on regulated market capitalism as the best way of organizing our economies, and that would promote economic growth and jobs for our citizens. And the third is that Europe would be a place of perpetual peace, and that it would even be a security exporter. And you know, the United States would be able to remove its soldiers, and NATO might even not need to exist anymore, right? Because Russia was going to become a partner. And I think all three of these assumptions that we had are really under threat. I mean, obviously the most serious one is what the Russians are up to, the annexation of Crimea, the war that they've been waging in Ukraine for the past 5 years, which has taken Australian lives, as I'm sure I don't need to remind your listeners, with MH17, and they're continuing, very kind of threatening maneuvers in Central and Eastern Europe in military exercises. In fact, I just saw in the news today that they were maybe potentially testing some potential nuclear warhead. That's prohibited by the treaty that the United States just pulled out of, and that there's now radioactive waste that they're trying to hide.
Yeah, the sense is, James, that it may well have been a nuclear powered missile. The missile itself is nuclear powered, which you're using one of these small modular reactors that they use in all sorts of other applications.
Right.
That being the case, that is a development, no doubt.
And certainly, that what that opens up now is kind of a Pandora's box, because now that we're out of the INF Treaty, there's talk now of stationing nuclear missiles in this part of the world to counter China, because China was never a part of that treaty, and China is obviously becoming more of a threat to its neighbors.
I want to come back to China in a moment. What's the purpose, do you think? What's Vladimir Putin's purpose in destabilizing the West? Is it just to keep it destabilized and a little bit wary and a little bit unsure of itself? Or is there an end game here for the Russians? What is the goal of Vladimir Putin?
I think it's similar, actually, to what the Chinese are doing in your region. And they have maybe different tactics and they go about it differently. But I think the end goal is basically to bring about a security environment that is more conducive to what these regimes want to accomplish, which is basically to, increase their influence and their control over their neighbors, and to basically have a veto over their neighbors, political and economic and security decisions. And so, Vladimir Putin famously said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. There are obviously many people in Central and Eastern Europe and Poland and the Baltic states and the Czech Republic who would beg to differ with that assumption. But he wants to basically reassert, control over that region and make Russia more preeminent than it's been. And I think that's the same thing the Chinese want to do, in the way that they are, interfering in the domestic politics of this country and many other countries, is that they want to help those forces, those domestic political forces that will basically allow them to get away with all sorts of things, whether it's, disrupting freedom of navigation or exerting economic and political pressure on democratic governments.
Mm. As the rise of China is clearly inexorable, and the sort of clash of civilizations, I hate to refer to it like that, but the clash of political movements, if you like, between the United States and China, will that see at some point, do you think, the necessity of bringing Russia into the argument, but on our side of the equation, to be a part of the bulwark for China? If you've got Russia on one side, the United States effectively on the other, and many others scattered around, and many other allies scattered around, including Europe and the UK, etc. Will that be necessary at some point to counter the rise of China, or coming together, if you like, of the European continent proper with the United States, or is that just not possible?
Oh, I don't think it's necessary. I think that the democratic world, by which I mean the United States and Canada and the European Union and Australia and Japan and Taiwan and South Korea, all these countries who I group together, I think we are far more powerful united than either China or Russia together or separate. I think the Chinese and the Russians have their own problems between them. There's lots of areas of friction. If you just look at the vast uninhabited area in, you know, eastern Russia, parts of Siberia, the Chinese are looking very hungrily at that territory, and the Russians know it. And let's not forget, you know, there was a Sino-Soviet split during the Cold War. So there's a lot of tension between Russia and China.
Okay, so on that basis then, as China becomes increasingly expansionist and to an extent belligerent, what will the Russians' position be going forward re-China? Might it be in their strategic interest to more hook up with the USA's interests?
Well, if they want to, that's fine. But we shouldn't be sacrificing our interests in order for that to happen.
Okay,
so
awesome.
We shouldn't recognize the annexation of Crimea, you know, in exchange for joining with Russia in some sort of, you know, team up on the Chinese. We shouldn't, you know, reduce our defense commitments to our NATO allies in Central and Eastern Europe to please Putin. I mean, we are the far stronger party here. I believe Russia has the same size economy as Australia, and it's a country five times the size of Australia.
Yeah, that's about right.
So it's not a very modern economy. They're basically just a giant gas station. They haven't modernized. They have a declining population. So it's, you know, but which is not to mean that they can't be a threat and they're not a problem. But I don't think we should exaggerate their, you know, global importance.
The you attended the Australia-America Leadership Dialogue in Perth last week. What was your take home from that, from the general vibe? And I hate using that term, but in these sort of contexts, but the general vibe of the meeting was that the relationship between Australia and the U.S. is,
I think, as strong as it's ever been. We have the largest congressional delegation of U.S. senators and congressmen since World War II, which I think is an indication of the importance that, you know, American political leaders are putting, not only on this region, but on Australia's role in the region. It's very hard to think of many other countries in the world that America has a closer relationship to than Australia. I would put just maybe Canada, the UK, Israel, and that's about it. I think we have the same values. We have a very similar history. I think Australians and Americans really understand one another, and we work very well together, and we've done that over the past 100 years, and I think it's a vitally important relationship, strategic relationship, a political and economic one, and I think it needs to remain strong as we confront very similar challenges.
What would your response be to those who argue, and some of them are in Australia, I won't mention names for fear of lawsuits and embarrassment, not necessarily in that order, who argue that it's actually in Australia's strategic interest long-term, and obviously economic interest, to become more closely aligned with Beijing at the expense of Washington? What would you say to those who mount that argument? I'm sure you'd know some of the names who are making it. Yeah. Go.
Well, I would just say, look at what's happening in Hong Kong right now, or look at what's happening to the Uyghurs. You know, 1 million people are put into re-education camps because of their religious belief. We have young students, you know, being oppressed because they're simply exercising their right to demonstrate. These are not Australian values. I don't see what, you know, I can't understand how anyone in Australia could look at China, at its political system, at the way it behaves internationally, and see that is somehow a system that Australians could in any way cooperate with. I think, you know, China is it is run by a communist party. It really doesn't have any real genuine allies. It basically has, you know, small neighbors who it bullies and threatens. And so I can't for the life of me understand why anyone in this country would see moving closer to China as being in Australia's, you know, strategic or even moral interest.
Yeah, the situation in countries like Cambodia, for example, and obviously Chinese influence stretching into Africa, certainly into the Pacific, with rumblings of potential bases in Vanuatu, which would be altogether too close for Australia's strategic interest, I would have thought. How do you stop that, or can we? Is the West in any position to do anything about this other than sit back and watch it?
Well, look, the Chinese are allowed to build military bases on a bilateral basis if they want, but they have to understand that there are international laws and international rules, and the United States, you know, is allowed to patrol in international waters. And as long as it is invited by Australia to, you know, station Marines in this country or the Philippines or Japan or Taiwan, you know, we have the right to fly the American flag through international waters. And I think that's what annoys the Chinese. They don't like the fact that the United States is the preeminent power in the Pacific, and they're seeking to displace us. And I think that's why it's very important that the United States work with its allies. And we have genuine allies in this region. You know, Australia and the United States, that is a genuine alliance of equal shared values. Both countries get something out of it. China and Russia, for that matter, they don't have genuine allies. They have countries that they bully and they threaten and they frighten into working with them. And I think over the long term, that's why I tend to be more optimistic, is because, you know, the American-Australian Western model of liberal democracy, if you want to call it, I think is just more appealing to people. And I think that's more appealing to nations, that they would rather work with a country like the United States. They'd rather work with Australia because they know that it's not a zero-sum game when it comes to dealing with liberal democracies.
Yeah. Just an observation, personal observation of yours. How do you think the Hong Kong situation is likely to resolve itself, and over what time frame?
I'm very worried, just because I think the Chinese really have the upper hand here. You know, there's not a whole lot that we can do in the West. They basically control that territory. You know, they're the ones with the troops on the ground. I think there are tools that we have at our disposal if things do take a turn for the worse, if they really pull out the tanks and try to attempt another Tiananmen Square, which I think would be awful. I think, you know, there are sanctions that we could use. There are other instruments of economic power that I think we can use to pressure the Chinese into, you know, warning them, you know, do not open fire on these people.
There's the lack of clarity as to the desired outcomes from the protesters.
Right.
It's sort of hindering the argument at the moment, because we don't quite know what they want.
Right, right. I mean, I think they've already achieved the initial goal, which was to basically get rid of this extradition treaty.
Yeah.
And now it's a little unclear. And so I think that they may be wandering into some dangerous waters there if they don't, you know, if they're not more clear about what it is exactly that they want and how they expect to achieve it.
Final question, back on Russia, if I may. What do you think Europe needs to do to contain the influence of Russia, covert or overt?
Well, I think one of the things that needs to be done, maybe there's a similar measure in this country, is they need to absolutely ban, you know, foreign political donations. And I'm not sure if that's allowed in this country, if foreign countries are allowed or foreigners are allowed to give money.
There are mechanisms by which they can, usually through corporate donations, James.
Right.
Yep.
And that should be banned. I mean, I can say one thing in the United States, you know, we have very kind of loose campaign spending laws. As you know, people spend hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, on a presidential campaign.
Yep.
But one thing that we're actually very strict about, you can get into serious trouble, as we've seen over the past couple of years with the people surrounding Donald Trump, is foreign interference and foreigners giving money or Americans accepting foreign money. And there's very few countries in Europe that have this. And so we've seen the Russians, you know, they're giving political money, often very overt. It's not even hidden, to various political forces across the continent. And I think that's just a very simple tool to basically, you know, increase transparency and stop foreign powers, whether, you know, it doesn't matter if they're democratic countries or non-democratic countries. They shouldn't be interfering in sovereign nations' political situations.
One of the things they love doing, though, is messing with our social media companies,
yep.
Facebook, etc. The Russians, well known for planting all sorts of, you know, so-called fake news and various memes around the place to suit their goals. How do we stop that? And the extent to which governments all over the world can seek the cooperation of companies like Facebook, like Twitter, etc., Instagram, are they likely to play, so to speak?
Well, I think they should be labeling anything that is coming from a foreign government. So if there's a Russian government, you know, Twitter account, it should be labeled as such, so that consumers of this information can understand that what they're seeing is not what it might appear to be. I know, you know, during the American election, they had many of these fake social media accounts, and they were pretending to be American citizens, and they were really operated by Russians in St. Petersburg. And so I think that there should be transparency about this. It's going to be very difficult, obviously, to just completely ban it and prevent it from entering the system, but to the extent that there can be transparency. And I think we need to also introduce, you know, media literacy courses, perhaps, for our young people in school, so that they understand, you know, how to consume news on the internet. It's not like the old days where you just picked up the newspaper and you understood what you were reading. Now people get their news mostly online, and it can be often confusing whether the sources that they're reading are legit news outlets or something more nefarious.
We live in a fascinating and rapidly evolving world. I genuinely appreciate your time and your expertise, James. Enjoy your time in Australia. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye.
James Kirchick, visiting fellow for the Centre on the United States and Europe and the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institute.